It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Researchers at Carnegie Mellon University are looking to implement a vast network of sensors and devices on their campus and into the city of Pittsburgh through a Google-sponsored initiative called the Internet of Things. Developers believe the project has the potential to profoundly change the way we approach the world around us, as well as improve city infrastructure, communication, and decision-making. But what would it look like if our cars could talk to coffee makers and our calendars to air conditioning units? Lead investigator for the project and director of CMU's Human-Computer Interaction Institute, Anind Day, shares his hopes for the CMU undertaking. He joins us in studio. Anind Day, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you for having me.
You can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002 for any questions or comments you may have about the Internet of Things, how it works, how it may make your life more efficient and convenient. Email is esspgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter at ESSPGH. Again, the number 412-246-2002. Anind Day, tell us about this project and what you are trying to accomplish with Google.
Google gave a substantial amount of money to CMU to create an infrastructure to support the Internet of Things, which is this idea that if you are able to place vast amounts of sensors and actuators, devices, into everyday infrastructure, into your homes, into your cars, into your workplace, and get that those devices and sensors to work together and communicate together, what kinds of experiences could you enable?
And so you've started to work on this. And how was CMU chosen?
CMU was one of several hundred applicants to this program that Google had. They made an open call for proposals about 8 months ago. We had the most compelling, Carnegie Mellon had the most compelling application or proposal for building and middleware infrastructure to support the Internet of Things. So we were the one chosen to lead this effort.
And CMU seems as though it would be a logical choice because this isn't your first rodeo, as it were.
That's right.
Now, explain the Internet of Things and what smart spaces are for people that are trying to wrap their minds around this concept.
Right. So if you take a space, and whether it's, let's take your home environment, for example, and you saturate it with sensors, and those are things that can both sense information, they can compute or infer information about the information that's being sensed, and then they can communicate that information with outside devices. And so it's the ability to take any information that's available about your physical environment and communicate it to other devices in that environment and to you yourself as a homeowner. So that's everything from your Nest thermostat that can communicate with a video camera to show you that, hey, your apartment, there's a fire in your apartment when you're at work.
Your thermostat can do that.
Your thermostat can do that.
Wow.
Right. So the Nest collection of products that is now under the Google umbrella, they have a thermostat, a carbon monoxide detector, and a camera, a web camera, that all can communicate with each other and deliver you alerts even when you're not at home.
This sounds like it's something that would be tremendously helpful and yet incredibly Orwellian. Like all of these devices acting upon themselves, communicating with each other. What happens? My mind always goes to the 2001 HAL computer scenario. Where all of a sudden it's like, Dave, you shouldn't be doing that.
Yes. I think the goal here is not to build an artificial intelligence like HAL was in 2001, but instead to use intelligence or to use machine intelligence to infer high-level information about oneself. Like, are you going to be on time for this meeting? What information would be valuable to you right now? And to push that information to you or make it available to you in some easy way. So in the same way that Siri or Google Now on your smartphone gives you access to information and services that you otherwise might not have, our goal is to extend the kind of information they can have access to into the physical world.
Okay, and I promise I won't dwell on this, but all right, let's say the devices sense that you should be doing something at a certain time and you happen to be procrastinating, and they decide to lock you in your house or lock you out of your car. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. I think the other thing that's really important here is that the end user will have control over what happens in any space. So if you don't install that program that's going to stop you from procrastinating, it's not going to be running in your space. So you don't need to worry about things taking over your life like that.
Okay. All right. Just wanted to check on that. How do you encourage cooperation between items like coffee pots and bus stops on campus and existing internet-connected products like smartphones? So we have the things that can talk to each other already, and then the things that do not necessarily aren't open to receiving messages yet. So that is that just done with the sensors?
So it's done with sensors and a communication link. So the sensors will sense something of interest, and then there will be a communication, a computational part, which will do some computation on that information, produce some higher level information, like the coffee pot is warm now, and we'll send that off to something that wants to consume that information. So it could be directly sent to you as an end user. It could be sent to an application that sets off a little light in your space, but something that would consume that information to be useful to you.
And in terms of you know, the broader community of Pittsburgh in general, what applications, you know, what sorts of applications came immediately to mind as being useful for this region?
Right. So the bridges, as being an obvious one, because we have so many bridges and some of them are not, unfortunately, in the best shape. You could imagine putting way more sensors on the bridges and being able to get in real time information about the quality of the bridges and whether a bridge needs repair. As the Port Transit Authority starts looking at what bus lines to expand or close or shift, we could use information about how people are using the public transit system, where they're coming from, where they're going, and be able to essentially set up new bus lines that are more efficient for the city.
We're talking with Anin Day. He is director of CMU's Human Computer Interaction Institute. And talking about the Internet of Things and the way that so many of our things, some of which are already connected and those that are not, will be connected in the future to make our lives more efficient, and this integration being created between items to not only enhance our lives, but the collective life of the city of Pittsburgh. If you have a comment or question about this, 412-246-2002 is the number to call. Again, 412-246-2002. If there's some aspect of this that you're curious about, wondering about, that may not make sense to you. Also, our email, esspgh@wesa.fm, and on Twitter at esspgh. Back into the problems. What kinds of problems do you anticipate beyond the ones that, you know, I was the science, the sci-fi ones that someone with an active imagination might imagine? What kinds of problems do you anticipate arising? What sorts of bugs will have to be worked out?
That's a great question. So there are some issues with just the massive scale of information that's being collected and disseminated. So if you imagine that there are sensors that are saturating the city of Pittsburgh, you're talking about millions of sensors that are all communicating information up. We certainly don't have the pipes or the internet bandwidth to be able to handle all that information. So one of our philosophies going into this project is to do as much of the computing or processing as close to the sensor as possible and only push up to the cloud, to the place where more computing is going to happen, the abstracted or the higher level information. But how to actually make that happen in a reliable, robust way is still a real concern or point of research for us.
What about what happens if the network goes down or there's a problem experienced such as we saw last week on Wall Street with the stock exchange?
I think this becomes a real problem when we've come to rely on a service. But we have to remember that when something like that happened in a smart space or a smart environment, we kind of would revert back to the way our lives are now, which are fairly unconnected other than our cell phone.
And in terms of privacy issues here, how will the project deal with hacking and privacy issues and, you know, people who want to protect their information? So much of our information is getting out there, and it would seem that with the addition of all of this stuff, that there would be more of that, it would, if not inviting an intrusion, that we would be putting out information that we maybe don't want people to know about.
There's certainly more of an opportunity here for those kinds of things. I think the two problems that are of interest here, and again, both are research problems, but also sort of real-world social problems, one is privacy and the other is security. So on the privacy side, you're worried about what information, what personal information about me is getting out. And on the security side, worried about who is using or who is accessing my devices to make them do things that I don't want them to do. So, you know, something fairly benign is changing the lighting while I'm in the room on me, but something less benign is taking control of my autonomous vehicle and making it drive somewhere I don't want to go.
Mm.
So on the privacy side, we have a couple of different approaches. Google was kind enough to not only sponsor our team, but an additional team looking at privacy. So we have two different privacy approaches. One approach is to look at automatically learning what kind of information you would reveal to different people in your lives. So if you're willing to reveal, you know, your exact GPS coordinates to people in your family, the system could learn that over time. And as you have introduced new family members into your system, that same information might be shared.
Would they need passwords and things to get access to that?
They wouldn't necessarily need that if the system was fairly confident that it had learned this about you. But on the other hand, if it wasn't confident about that, then yes, you would have to share something explicitly with them to get access to that.
412-246-2002 if you have a comment or question about the Internet of Things, which CMU is working on through a Google grant. Who came up with this idea initially that we could integrate much more of our devices and get them talking to each other so that our lives could be run that much more efficiently?
That's another good question. I actually don't know the answer to that. The idea of a smart home has been around for over 100 years. I've seen old magazines.
Over 100 years?
I've seen these old magazines from 1906 and some cartoons from the late 1800s where they've sort of positioned this idea or thought of these ideas of sensors everywhere and things that can communicate with people while you're on a public transportation system. It's pretty impressive how futuristic they were thinking. So it's really hard to say who to attribute the original idea to.
And, you know, the other sort of aspect of this, you know, people have been wondering, you know, for years, you know, what happens if the internet goes down? What happens if a solar flare makes the whole grid, you know, this huge domino effect of everything crashing? And we're sort of left with no knowledge of how to do things because so much of it is done for us. And this sort of seems to render human beings and the human brain that much less capable of thinking and of doing things and therefore thinking things through for ourselves. Are we in some way giving over some of the capacity of our brains to machines?
In some sense, yes. But in the same way that I don't remember anybody's phone number today, I'm not sure that I really
right.
needed to remember anybody's phone. I need to remember. I could always look it up on a piece of paper if I had to. So I'm hoping we're shifting that capacity. So rather than using it on things that are really about efficiency, I can now be using it on things that actually can make a difference.
So you're saying that rather than, you know, we've got our brains are so cluttered with all this, you know, minutia that can be stored somewhere else other than in our memories, that we're using the memory space to store other more important things?
I'm hoping at least. That's the story I'll go with.
Okay. Yeah, that's your story and you're sticking to it.
That's right.
All right. That sounds good. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. And our guest, Anin Day, is the lead investigator for the project, The Internet of Things, and is the director of CMU's Human-Computer Interaction Institute. Again, we have a few minutes left, so if you want to join the conversation, 412-246-2002. Apparently, you're doing a remarkable job of answering everybody's questions because nobody's tripped on anything yet. How many sensors should Pittsburgh expect to encounter?
I think in an ideal world, we would be in the millions.
Millions.
Right. I mean, in any one home, you should have, you'd be in the thousands. And obviously, any one person is not going to deploy all of those sensors themselves. But the idea is that, you know, you'd have a handful of them, and you'd be able to scatter them around your environment, and they would just start learning about you.
Now, we have a email question from Guy in Pittsburgh. He says, we can't protect our data and the internet as it exists today. It sounds like a security The Internet of Things sounds like a security nightmare. Comment?
I would say that there's a lot of truth behind that. There are very few devices that have been placed online that haven't been hacked. So you hear about people's insulin pumps that have been hacked, or people's OnStar cars that have been hacked so that people can take over the car while you're in the midst of driving. So it is pretty scary, the potential here. I will say that while I don't have a great answer for how to address this, we are taking security extremely seriously, and we'll make sure that first all data is protected, but any access to systems that can perform an action, any actuators, would be extremely secure.
I'll take your word for it. it sounds so much like what we do in America. We just forge ahead and worry about some of this stuff down the road.
That's not untrue.
Okay. Let's go to the phones. We have David in Pittsburgh on the line. David, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Yeah, I was concerned about security because, once you create a profile of an individual and then you go ahead and start making toasters and things to do and then you create this profile, what do you do with the information? Because once you got it, you know, Google doesn't let it go because It retains the information forever, and once it has it, it can actually be sold to information brokers, or we don't know what it can do because it can build upon itself and then continually build, and that information can be, I hate to say it, but it could be one of them Snowden things. It can actually be an infamy, where it can actually be used against us in the long run, and it can actually go on and on and on. And that's what I'm concerned with, because once you start getting to know us on our little trips, just to Giant Eagle or little trips anywhere, then you get to know us so well. I'm concerned with those things. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dave. Well, you bring up a lot of good concerns, and it's not as though we are not hearing, just a few days ago that 20 million, the information of 20 million government employees right. was obtained by hackers. So David brings up a legitimate concern here.
Absolutely. One thing I did want to say is that while Google has been very generous in supporting us in this project, we're not necessarily using Google technology, which is maybe a positive thing for those that are more concerned about privacy. I think the more relevant point to make, though, is that no one single infrastructure or corporate stakeholder will have access to this data. In an ideal world, your data would sit in your home under your control. So it would only go to people that you want to go to. So Google would have no access to this data unless you explicitly gave them permission to access it.
Is there the chance that, somebody who isn't as tech savvy could make a mistake that allows it to fall into the wrong hands?
Absolutely. So one of the things that we're working on is essentially to have a tracking mechanism after the fact. So should such a disclosure be made accidentally, the user could get notified about it almost immediately.
What will this look like for students and staff at CMU?
In the fall, which is coming up very soon, we'll have a few different spaces that are instrumented on the CMU campus. So those spaces should look exactly the same as they do today, but their experiences in using those spaces should fundamentally change. So there will be interactions where lighting will change and temperatures will change and information will be presented to them about what's happening around the corner or across campus. Into the spring semester, we hope to have a large part of CMU instrumented and then move on to the city.
412-246-2002. Let's go to Bill in Mount Washington. Bill, you're on Essential Pittsburgh with Anin Day.
Hi. Thanks for taking my question. I was curious as to whether or not they are pursuing an integration of wearable sensors and into the program and how it might relate to, say, someone had an acute medical condition, maybe a heart attack or something. And are they pursuing any type of application like that?
That's a great question, but it strikes at the heart of what this could mean for people with medical issues.
Right. So I guess there's two parts to your question. The first is, are we leveraging wearable devices? And I would say our goal is to leverage wearable fitness trackers, heart rate monitors, things like that. Carryable devices, mobile devices like your cell phone, and then sensors and devices that are physically placed in your infrastructure. So we want to leverage all three of those. But your second part of your question is very interesting, and that sort of focuses on the relevance of Internet of Things to either the medical domain or healthcare in general. There's a lot of interest on how this kind of technology can be used, not just for acute conditions like you're referring to now, but sort of long-term conditions like cognitive decline or Parkinson's disease, things that don't have this really acute situation like the heart attack that you mentioned. Absolutely, this technology should be used for those in those situations. And in fact, I just spoke with a physician this morning who's going to be joining our team as an advisor to help us figure out exactly the kinds of applications that we should be building and the stakeholders who need to be involved in such a thing, like insurance companies, physicians, occupational therapists, etc.
So again, this would be, I'm just trying to envision this because I think everybody worries about, you know, what happens if in the middle of the night, you have a heart attack or a stroke, you know, something like that happens, and you're trying to pull yourself together to communicate this to somebody. So you would be wearing sensors that would immediately tell somebody this person's having a problem?
Yeah, so that would either be something that's in the bed or something that you would wear on your body, absolutely.
See, in the bed, now that is something that you don't have to remember to put on. That's right. Just that's perfect. Let's go to Holly in Oakland. Hi, Holly. Welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hi there. I'm wondering if you are considering accessibility to people with various types of disability when you're designing the system. For instance, people who can't see or people who can't hear, these kinds of things, or if there's a way, if you can design a way while you're doing it, a way for them to access the data.
Another great question.
Yes. So the great thing about the department that I'm the chair of is that there is a large number of people that focus on issues of accessibility, primarily people with hearing or vision impairments. And so we've already started working with a number of these stakeholder groups to give us input on the kinds of interactions that they would like to see. And that means two different things. The first is, what kind of applications would be preferable to these different stakeholders? But also, what should the interface look like for somebody who is visually impaired? Would a speech interface be more appropriate versus some other kind of interface?
Thank you for that that question, Holly. And this would be a good moment to remind people that this is the month that the Americans with Disability Act turns 25, and we're having a special program on Wednesday, which looks at the anniversary and the development of the legislation for Americans with Disabilities, the ADA. And, of course, our community forum is being held that night. It'll take place here at the Community Broadcast Center. We'll have some more details on that a little bit later in the program to pass along. But we've come to time for this segment. And I wanted to thank our guest again, Anin Day, who is with CMU's Human-Computer Interaction Institute, talking about the Internet of Things. It's been absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much for stopping by our studios today.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, we will talk about a part of this area of the country, Meadowcroft Rock Shelter and Historic Village, the oldest site of human habitation in North America, and explain why it might never have been discovered. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. For 90.5 WESA celebrates Inventing Pittsburgh, Margaret J. Krause reports that while the city wasn't a major center of car manufacturing, the region's thinkers and tinkerers got America motoring and continue to do so in the 21st century.
On a side street in Bloomfield, not far from Pittsburgh's Automobile Row on Baum Boulevard, Tom Lynn points out the cars he's restoring at his business, Flop Custom.
Everything up here is original Ford. I mean, there's a 30 Ford that I chopped, another 30 Ford, a 31 Roadster, a 32 truck, that's a 28 Ford, and that's a 32 Ford three-window. This stuff needs a lot of work to get right. Ford made 4 million Model A's between 28 and 31. It came off the assembly line, I think one every 20 minutes, and it takes me months to do one car.
At the turn of the 20th century, Pittsburgh workshops played a role in creating the automobile, but assigning sole credit for its development is pretty tricky. Leonardo da Vinci designed a car that ran on clockwork in 1478. A French engineer created a three-wheeled tractor in 1769 to haul artillery. Until gasoline-powered vehicles dominated the market, electric and steam-powered engines jockeyed for consumer affection.
Most manufacturing cities had sort of fledgling automakers. So I don't know that Pittsburgh was more unusual than, say, Cleveland or Buffalo or Auburn, Indiana.
Sarah Hall is director of curatorial affairs at the Frick Art and Historical Center, home to the Car and Carriage Museum. She says the early days of the car were an innovation race.
Between, say, 1890 and 1910, there were a lot of startup sort of tinkerers and investors trying to create cars here in Pittsburgh.
Pittsburgh capitalized on existing industries, including steel and glass, and produced the steam-powered Artsberger, a model capable of tackling the city's hills. But auto production centralized in Detroit. So, Pittsburgh contributed something else. Infrastructure.
Pittsburgh-based Gulf Oil opened the first drive-in gas station in 1913.
The station was staffed 24 hours a day. It provided free water and air and produced the very first road map. Hall says the car transformed everyday life.
It opened up the world. People could go farther. They could see more. They could choose where they wanted to go and when.
But there were drawbacks to that newfound independence and possibility.
Life sort of decentralized because of the car. And, you know, walkability in neighborhoods was less valued.
Or simply became more dangerous. City streets ceased to be public spaces and instead became places for cars. Hall says it took a while to figure out coexistence and regulation.
I'm Costas Samaras. I'm an assistant professor of civil and environmental engineering at Carnegie Mellon University.
30 years ago, CMU invented the autonomous car, and two groups work on self-driving vehicles today. Samaras doesn't make the cars. He researches their implications for society.
This could be as game-changing as the car. With self-driving cars, people can schedule where they want to be, how they want to get there in a whole new way. Society has a lot of choices ahead of it as we enter this age of automation to maximize the benefits and minimize the downsides.
This isn't a time of incremental change, says Samaras. Most cars sit idle 95% of the time. A shared, schedulable, self-driving fleet will revolutionize transit and daily life, affecting how people decide where to live and work and how cities are structured.
What's exciting about engineering in general is that you're building the world anew every time.
But the new world of self-driving cars is bringing back old questions about safety, energy, and the environment. The difference, says Samaras, is the benefit of knowing how cars have affected society over the past 100 years. For 90.5, WESA celebrates Inventing Pittsburgh. I'm Margaret J. Krause.
UPMC is proud to support 90.5 WESA celebrates Inventing Pittsburgh. UPMC, life-changing medicine.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. If not for the curiosity of a Washington County farmer 6 decades ago, the oldest site of human habitation in North America might never have been discovered. Senator John Hines History Center President and CEO Andy Masick is here today to discuss Meadowcroft Rock Shelter and Historic Village in Avella, Pennsylvania. Andy Masick, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
It's good to be here.
Andy, this year Meadowcroft is celebrating the 60th anniversary of the discovery of the rock shelter. How was the site discovered?
Well, it was back in 1955 that Albert Miller, one of the Miller brothers who owned that property down there near that old coal patch town of Avella in western Pennsylvania, saw a groundhog excavating a hole near the sort of cave entrance. And he watched curiously as the animal scooped away the dirt. And then this stone point, this arrowhead came shooting out of the hole, and Albert went over and picked it up and dusted it off, and it was gray stone, obviously napped by hand, a piece of flint, and he was fascinated by this thing and took it to the University of Pittsburgh, where the archaeologists there examined it. And they passed it around, and they said, well, yeah, we know exactly what that is. And Albert said, well, tell me. And they said, well, it's probably about 15,000 years old, and it's from Germany. And Albert said, no, it's not. It's from Avella. It's from Meadowcroft. And they said, no, that's impossible. because when human beings were making points like this, there were no human beings in North America. This predates human occupation of the Americas. And Miller says, no, that can't be right. Let me show you the spot. And he brought the archaeologist down to Meadowcroft, and that's where it all began. It caused an archaeological sensation, and a guy named James Atavasio, a young PhD archaeologist from the University of Pittsburgh, took it on as his personal project to excavate the site. And after 20 years of excavation, they went down more than 20 feet and found that it was, in fact, the oldest site of human habitation in North America, and that that stone point really rolled back the clock and the archaeologists' thinking about when human beings got to the Americas.
What did Dr. Atavasio's team find?
Well, they found layer after layer. The archaeologists call it stratigraphy, the layering of culture or civilization. They looked at the fire pits or the hearths that had been used by the people who lived in this cave-like setting over 16,000 years ago. And by radiocarbon dating the charcoal that was in those fire pits, they could determine when people were there. They found lots of other material, too, woven materials, seeds, bones, remains of plants and pollen, all of which could tell them about what the environment was like 16,000 years ago, right up to present. And think about this for a minute. 20,000 years ago, America was a very different place. It was during the Ice Age, and ice a mile thick, glaciers a mile thick, covered much of North America. In fact, the weight of this glacial mass was so great that it depressed the mantle of the earth. So the Allegheny River that flows to the south today actually flowed northward 20,000 years ago because the earth was depressed just by the weight of this ice. Well, as the ice sheets retreated, the ice melted, the earth rebounded. And
that's
the water,
why all this is underground.
Well, it flowed the other, water flowed the opposite direction after the earth rebounded. The reason we find this material underground is just the layer of vegetal matter and human occupation built it up. It never got flooded because it's high enough on this cave, in this ravine, that the floodwaters never reached this location. And that's why it's so well preserved.
And what do people make of just the happenstance, the serendipitous discovery of this, that nothing other than a groundhog led people who had expertise in this to discover where this all was, to realize that it was located there?
Well, you know, much of archaeology is serendipitous. People find objects and bring them to the scientists, and the scientists then explore more fully using very controlled techniques so they can document the layers of living and the association of objects. But you're right. Still, this is the oldest documented site of human habitation in the Americas. There have been other sites found as far as southern Chile in South America. The Monteverde site has been documented at 13 or 14,000 years old. And there they find stone points, lithics they call them, in association with extinct horses and mammoths, other animals that are no longer around. So there are some other rich sites out there, but there's no site that has a continuous history and record of occupation over 16,000 years, continuous occupation over 16,000 years.
The Heinz History Center now operates Meadowcroft. When did that relationship begin, and what can visitors see when they travel to Avella, Pennsylvania to visit the site?
Well, the Miller brothers, Albert and Delvin Miller, really started a museum there at a site of an old Boy Scout camp in the 1960s. And then in later years, the Heinz History Center merged with the Meadowcroft Museum. And just about 10 years ago, the National Park Service designated this site a National Historic Landmark. That's a pretty rare and special designation. Only about 3% of all the sites that are on the National Register of Historic Places are considered historic landmarks or monuments like this. And so the History Center has overseen the development of the site. We've built a shelter over the rock shelter, and there's also a 18th century village there. You can actually see houses moved in, log cabins, a schoolhouse, a blacksmith shop, and actually participate in living history activities. You can also throw an atlatl. Now, do you know what an atlatl?
No, sir.
Well,
what is an atlatl?
10 to 15,000 years ago, if you needed to bring down a saber-toothed cat, a giant sloth, or maybe a mammoth, you needed a pretty big arrow to do that, or a spear that you could throw really hard. Well, most human beings can't just throw a spear hard enough to penetrate the tough wool of a mammoth. So by adding a joint to your arm, by using a spear thrower, an atlatl, you actually can increase the force with which you can throw a 6-foot-long spear with a stone tip on it. You could actually throw it through a buffalo. I mean, that's how much force. You could hurl a spear 300 yards. I mean, it's remarkable what one more joint to your arm. Imagine if Burnett of the Pirates had one... A.J. Burnett. Imagine if he had one more forearm on the end of his arm. How fast could he hurl a baseball? He'd probably throw it through the catcher with such force. Well, that's what these prehistoric people were doing with their spear throwers. By adding another joint to their arm, they could hurl it with amazing accuracy and great force and bring down big game animals.
Learn something every day from Andy Masick. He's president and CEO of the Heinz History Center, and you can find out more about Meadowcroft by going to your website, I would imagine.
You can find us on the website. Just Google Meadowcroft, and you'll find a wealth of information.
And we'll put a link to that at our website at WESA.FM. Andy Masick, thank you as always.
You bet.
More Essential Pittsburgh coming up. This is 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. The city of Pittsburgh has likely never witnessed 48 hours of regular season baseball as exciting as that played by the Pirates at PNC Park in the past 2 days. The Pirates staged 2 straight extra inning rallies to beat the first place St. Louis Cardinals to move to 2.5 games behind the first place Redbirds as we reach the All-Star break. Here to talk about that and the All-Star Game is our sports guy, Pittsburgh Post-Gazette sports writer emeritus Bob Dvorak. Hi, Bob.
Hey, Paul. I'll tell you, my overriding observation on this, where was this team when I was covering the Pirates?
What were the years, Bob, that you covered the Pirates?
Well, I covered the Freak Show back in 97, and then the first 4 years when they opened PNC Park. You remember when they lost 100 games, Operation Shutdown, you know, the real... highlights in franchise history.
Well, you know, you would have seen, if you started in 97, you would have seen that the last no-hitter pitched by the Pirates here, right?
Yeah, actually, that was just the anniversary, just the other day. Ricardo Rincon in relief of Francisco Cordova.
So you were there?
Oh, absolutely. You know I was. Now, one of the most exciting nights I can remember at a baseball park.
And probably nothing, probably the last big excitement, you know, other than the playoff games, but we're talking about regular season games, probably... that game represented a certain benchmark that was not reached until this past weekend with the games that the Pirates played. There was an interesting remark made by one of the ESPN commentators. The game, of course, was a national telecast, which is another thing that didn't happen very often when you were covering the team. ESPN had the game last night, and Curt Schilling and either Curt Schilling or John Kruk said, you know, if the Pirates rally to win this game, this could be season-changing. Do you see it that way?
Oh, absolutely. I do. The last two nights especially, the winning the series with the Cardinals when they had to right before the break, I mean, they really did pick their spot. And what happens is this team believes in itself that it can come back no matter what, no matter against whom. So once you have that belief, anything's possible. Then it's contagious. And once the city starts to believe in them, and that energy starts to feed off each other. I'm afraid we've got a full-blown outbreak of pennant fever, Paul. It's not going to be pretty the rest of the summer, I'm telling you.
How much more meaningful and how much how much does it stir optimism that it's not just one guy getting it done? Last night, you know, Jordy Mercer gets a hit, and then Francisco Cervelli gets a hit, and then Polanco gets a hit, and you know it's everybody's contributing to this success.
Yeah, and don't forget your Zheng Ho Gong, the Gong Show. I mean, what an addition to this team! He's sort of been like the unseen star in a lot of these little rallies that they put together. And the knock, of course, on the Pirates was, well, they didn't have a reliable enough offense. Well, that offense did come alive when they needed it the most. One night, it's your superstar MVP. The next night, it's all the guys who have to contribute. And believe me, you don't win unless everybody's pulling together and contributing.
And they're doing it against, for a while, the knock against the Pirates was, yeah, they're winning a lot of games when they played bad teams. And then they go into a place like Washington and they not only get swept, but they get no hit. But they beat a very good, the Pirates and the Cardinals right now stand as the best teams in the National League. And the Cardinals, their record is slightly better, but the Pirates beat them. So that really has
and,
go ahead.
Yeah, not to take anything away from the Pirates, because it really does really end the first half on a high note. You get to marinate in this for 4 days. It's great. Sometimes it's when you play a team, though, Paul. You know, the Pirates were coming off a road trip in Washington and ran into that wall. St. Louis, 8 games in 7 days at the end of a road trip. You know, I wouldn't say they were vulnerable, but I think they didn't have the energy that they've had before, and I think that was evident in some of the mistakes they make. Because, listen, that's a good baseball team. And people say, well, we hate the Cardinals because they're so good. I mean, goodness sakes, the scouting director got fired aside. This is a team of fundamentally sound baseball players up and down the lineup.
Right, he got fired for the breach of internet security.
It's always something with these guys.
We're talking with our sports guy, Bob Dvorak. And, Bob, you know, proof of that the Pirates have arrived, as if we needed much more, is the fact that they have, I think it's more All-Stars and certainly more starting pitchers on the All-Star team than they have had in years. Tell us a little bit about the history that's being made here and who is on the team for the National League.
Yeah, and if the season reminds you of 1960 a little bit, when the Pirates would always come from behind, including that Game 7 against the Yankees, they had 8 All-Stars that year, and 2 starting pitchers, Vernon Law and Bob Friend, and each of them started an All-Star game because there were 2 All-Star games that year. Remember the years when the Pirates were sending one guy to the All-Star game? It would be like Ed Sprague or Gabby Sanchez, and you're scratching your head saying, you know, where's the talent? Well, it's pretty evident now. It's a nice team. I listened to those national broadcasters too, Paul, and I heard all of them say that's John Crook and Curt Schilling, this is a team that can play in the World Series. That doesn't mean they will, but they're good enough, they're sound enough, they have the tools. So it's a question of them getting it done.
And as far as the the history of the All-Star Game's been played in Pittsburgh quite a few times, and the most recent, of course, being 2006. Did you cover that one, Bob?
Yeah, it was. Trevor Hoffman blew the lead in the ninth inning, and it was an American dream and a national nightmare. But to have the All-Star Game, the spectacle, the greatest stars of the entertainment industry on display on the red carpet there, it's wonderful.
And you mentioned the year that they played two, one of which was in Pittsburgh. Why were they playing two All-Star Games?
Oh, well, back then, baseball wanted to raise money for the pension fund for the players who had come before and weren't being adequately taken care of. So they decided that instead of just one All-Star Game, they'll have two and use that money to take care of player benefits. Of course, that's a moot point these days with the salaries they make. And two, you shut down the season twice in the major league. That didn't work very well.
Right. And tomorrow night's game is being played in Cincinnati. The last time it was played there, 1970, was the famous Pete Rose crash at the home plate when he knocked over the American League catcher Cleveland's Ray Fosse in extra innings to win the game. It was a violent collision. Both, got up very slowly, the kind of thing that you would not see probably in an All-Star game today, I'm guessing.
You wouldn't even see it in a regular season game because the catcher is not allowed to block the plate anymore, right? So they have to clear a path, give the runner a clear path. But I think what that play shows, Paul, and they're still talking about it, is that those guys played to win. That was the idea, was to win. They didn't need an incentive like this is for home field advantage in the World Series or, whatever. They wanted to win the game. And I think that's changed some in baseball through the years.
And even though he's banned from baseball and banned from the Hall of Fame, Pete Rose will be at the game tomorrow night in Cincinnati, which seems appropriate. He was just here in the area, in the Pittsburgh area, making an appearance as a base coach, kind of a promotional thing, obviously, for the Washington Wild Things. What about this, though? What kind of a scene do you anticipate tomorrow?
Charlie Hustler, I've seen him up in Cooperstown selling his autograph for $10 a piece. And, of course, he's banned from the Hall of Fame. This is Pete Rose. It's sort of like, I've got Pete Rose fatigue. I don't want to hear about this anymore. He denied for years that he bet on baseball as a player and a manager. Then we wrote a book and admitted it. He accepted the ban from baseball thinking he'd be reinstated and, what's really changed? I do know that there's a sign on every major league clubhouse door that has the rule against gambling on your team or against your team. It's just strictly prohibited, with the penalty being suspension for life.
We're talking with our sports guy, Pittsburgh Post-Gazette sports writer emeritus, Bob Dvorak. Bob, we're down to just about a minute here, but I wanted to take a moment to remember Ken Stabler, the late Oakland Raiders quarterback, who passed away over the weekend. The cause of his death at the age of 69 was colon cancer. His family says his brain and spinal cord were donated to a Boston University center that conducts research into degenerative brain disease among athletes. Explain what a move like this means on the part of Kenny Stabler.
Yeah, I think what he's doing is donating his organs to study how much damage was caused to them by the act of playing football. Is football too violent? The snake was one of the real characters of his day, and he was on the other side of the Immaculate Reception, obviously. But I always remembered him saying that it was okay to study the game plan by the light of the jukebox.
He liked to party, but they said he always got his homework done. That's what John Madden said. Bob Dvorak is our sports guy, Pittsburgh Post-Gazette sports writer emeritus. As always, Bob, great pleasure. Thank you. Enjoy the All-Star Game.
Oh, thank you, Paul. And listen, it's set. The baseball fever is here.
Okay. Sounds good. Thanks again. And before we wrap up, I wanted to get to a comment that someone had about our first segment, the Internet of Things, From Hannah, she says the Internet of Things is totally unnecessary. This is just another 1950s style marketing trick to fool me into believing that my life could somehow be simpler and easier if only I buy this miracle product that I had never even fathomed before. Shame on Google. Shame on the scientists. They're not addressing a problem that exists. They're creating solutions to problems that no one has. On that note, thank you for listening. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.